The committee will come to order. There's a quorum. Representative Moro, I took the wrong one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd like to move approval of the minutes of February 15, 2010.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No? Miss Heidi, who are you? Are we going there? Heidi Castleberg?
I just have these.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
My name is Dr. Heidi Kastenberg. I'm the Division Director for the Dairy and Food Inspection Division. And with me today is David Reed, our Food Program Manager and the Assistant Division Director. We've been asked today to talk about our enforcement process. And so what we'd like to start out with is a short video that describes how our inspection process works in concert with our enforcement process.
Americans eat from the safest food supply in the world. This doesn't happen by luck or accident. A lot of hard work goes into ensuring the food we eat is safe and wholesome. But whose job is it? Join us as we go behind the scenes of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Food Inspection Program. When the refrigerator and cupboards are bare, we head to the grocery store. But the story of food safety doesn't start or even end there. It's the job of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, or MDA, to make sure you're eating or drinking a safe product. MDA is the enforcer of state laws and regulations related to food production, processing, and sale. MDA also conducts inspections for the Federal Food and Drug Administration using state authorities. It's MDA's Dairy and Food Inspection Division that oversees inspections from everything from dairy farms and food processing plants to grocery stores and convenience stores. Let's take a look at three facilities where your family's food comes from: a food processing plant, a bakery, and a grocery store.
My name is Andy Seibert, and I'm a food inspector with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. What I'm here for today is a routine inspection of a manufacturing facility. They manufacture ingredients for use in the food industry.
Food inspectors conduct an average of 7,500 inspections each year. From floor to ceiling, inspectors examine every part of the facility and manufacturing process to make sure the end result is a safe product.
We want to make sure that the product is handled in a safe fashion, that they're not introducing any adulterants or foreign matter into the product, that it's not coming from anywhere else, and that the facility is free of vermin, insects, or rodents, and that type of thing, and that it's that there really aren't any microbial hazards here at this place.
Inspectors are often accompanied by a representative of the facility. During the inspection, they discuss issues that may develop.
As we discuss the inspection as we're going on, and we discuss different ways in which they're cleaning or handling product or just some of the manufacturing that's going on as it is. In addition to protecting the public, it's also important to help protect the places I work for. I want to make sure we all have the same interests and goals in mind, and that I don't want them having any problems any more than they do.
Inspectors follow the manufacturing process through the plant, but backwards. They start with the most critical areas where the actual processing takes place. If some sort of food contamination were to happen, this would be the first place inspectors would look.
And what I'd be looking at this is just if you could seal some of the edges around the cuts there.
From there, inspectors look at product handling before the processing. They end up at point of entry, where everything comes into the plant. No part of the plant is left unchecked.
You want to make sure, because some of these more forgotten places are some of the places that can potentially have some of the problems that we'd be looking for.
But no inspection is the same. Each manufacturer, each store, offers a unique situation with a different set of challenges.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bigger with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm a food inspector. Today we're inspecting Franklin Street Bakery. For bakeries, it ultimately will get cooked. So, but you want to, along the way, make sure you're not adding anything to the product that you don't intend to be in it. Usually flour will have things like flour beetles. Rodents are also attracted to bakeries sometimes, depending on the product. So those things you want to look for. But ultimately, handling of the product once it's cooked and making sure that employee handling of the product throughout the process is not adding anything to the bread that wasn't intended to be in it. Observing hand washing.
Inspectors not only look at worker hygiene, they make sure proper safety measures are taken. Hairnets are worn and jewelry is not.
Coolers have a thermometer usually. And since this is a refrigerator, we like to see it below 40.
Armed with a thermometer, inspectors also make sure ingredients going into the final product are kept cool in order to minimize spoilage and unsafe bacteria. Temperature readings are taken and product date expiration dates are noted.
We can look at the egg date.
Inspection rules and regulations have changed over the years in an effort to ensure the safety of our food supply. And one key area that's become more important than ever is addressing food allergens.
So this product has nuts on it, and it's being stored underneath all the other products so that if a nut were to fall off, it wouldn't fall onto another product.
NDA staff also monitor and provide guidance on food labeling, making sure all potential allergens are declared right on the package. Again, from top to bottom, MDA's food inspectors are trying to ensure all food and beverages produced in Minnesota are the safest possible.
The inspection process just makes sure that the operators are doing what they're supposed to. So it's a very important process, but the most important process is having knowledgeable employees and knowledgeable operators.
Knowledge is key at the place where most of us come into contact with food, the grocery store.
I'm Catherine Freemeyer, a food inspector with the Dairy and Food Inspection Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today we're inspecting a grocery store and we are going through the deli, bakery, fresh meat, and general grocery areas.
Food inspectors look at their job in two ways, as enforcer of rules and regulations and as educator.
How it says barley flour, it's a huge teaching opportunity to be able to help people understand the interaction between the rules that we're coming to enforce and to know the reasoning behind them so that they have a better way to make their own decisions on a day-to-day basis when we're not here.
One of the most diverse areas of food inspection is the grocery store. Not only are there food storage issues, but some of the items we purchase at the store are made right on site.
We look for the things that are the most potentially hazardous, which would be a ready-to-eat, hot or cold-held foods, and then working down through some of the room temperature stuff where it's still ready to eat, and then some of the stuff that's going to be further processed or that's not potentially hazardous, like the general grocery areas where it's just dry storage holding issues.
Correct temperatures are critical to food safety.
Have any of these salads been out recently?
Inspectors make it a point to talk with employees to make sure they are aware of proper procedures and regulations.
Is this just sanitizer that you use, or do you use any cleaning in between?
We do clean them between, but I want them sanitized after every time.
After each area is thoroughly checked, it's time to turn to the report. Whether they're at a grocery store, bakery, or food processing plant, each inspector completes a written report outlining observations and any situations that need to be remedied.
We have two parts to the report. The first part is, it's kind of like a cover sheet. The top half is considered foodborne illness risk factors and public health interventions. These are all things that have been directly linked to various foodborne illness outbreaks. So that would include employee hygiene, such as hand washing, approved source of their foods, a lot of the temperature issues that we look for, whether it's cooling, cooking, hot holding, cold holding.
The bottom half of the report outlines good retail practices. While still important for running a food facility, these practices are a bit less critical. These issues include clean floors, appropriate plumbing, and food labeling. The second half of the report includes written comments and any issues that need to be taken care of to bring a facility into compliance.
What we're looking for is pretty much people who have lots of food handling.
The final component of any inspection involves a meeting between the inspector and members of the business management team. They go over the report and discuss any changes that could or need to be made. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's food inspection program is key to food safety. The department works closely with processors and retailers to improve and maintain their procedures. It truly is a partnership.
Sometimes there's compromises, give and take between the two of us as far as what needs to be done, what should be done, what has to be done. But in reality, the whole thing, it's a partnership that helps us produce a better, safer product.
I view the inspection process very helpful. They really come in and look at what we're doing, offer suggestions for things that maybe we're not doing properly. They really come in and just look at what we're doing and make sure that we're doing a good job. It's important for us to do a good job, and they really just offer help.
The fact I've worked in like five or six states, and Minnesota tends to be, I would say, more stricter, but they're just ahead of the game, I guess, and I've learned that. And I think they would do a good job as far as they come and present the problem to us, and then they help us educate us how to get rid of the problem.
That partnership also includes other government agencies. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture investigates reports of food contamination, working together with state and local health officials to determine the cause of outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. NDA employees work hard each day to ensure your family's food is safe to eat. But why is it important for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to take on this duty?
When you buy your food at a grocery store, the typical consumer doesn't know exactly where it came from. They don't know all the people that were involved in making that product, and so it's important for somebody like the Department of Agriculture to be involved in that process and overseeing what's going on in the facilities to make sure that the product is a safe product for the consumer and it is what they think they're buying. I think we have a lot of ability to get to the bottom of an issue. We have the ability to do any trace back issues back to manufacturers that we may inspect, or maybe just figuring out how the different areas are handling, whether it's through distribution.
With the authority to enforce state laws and regulations, the department is also able to provide something no one else can, a consistent inspection system across all of Minnesota. By unifying the process, the MDA avoids a patchwork of agencies trying to provide inspections and safeguards to the state's food supply. Overlap or possibility of gaps in the food safety system are minimized. This also results in efficient use of public resources. So at the end of the day, there's just one goal: to protect your food from farm to table. And it's all thanks to a group of dedicated employees from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Now we'd like to expand on our enforcement process at the Dairy and Food Inspection Division. The mission of the Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, is to enhance the quality of life for all Minnesotans by ensuring the integrity of the food supply, health of the environment, and the strength of our agricultural economy. As our name might suggest, our part in this mission, our role, is to ensure the integrity of the food supply. To do this, we have our divisions divided into programs: food, dairy, meat, egg, and poultry, and also feed inspection. And then to support those functions, we've got data management and administrative support. We also cooperate and involve other agencies in the food supply. And so here's a graphic that depicts the farm-to-table continuum. The Board of Animal Health has regulatory authority primarily at the farm level, and that's for primarily live animal diseases. We overlap there a bit because we have regulatory authority at the farm level as well for dairy farms. So we regulate dairy farms, then we go on to the processor level. Dairy farms, food processing, meat processing, egg processing, and then also feed mills. Moving on to the distribution, trucking agencies, cold storage warehouses, and the like are also under our statutes. When we get to the retail level, this is where what you would consider the grocery store. We have jurisdiction over there, and that's where our regulatory authority ends. The next part of this chain is at the home or at the restaurant level. And that is where the Department of Health takes over. Now, one way you can kind of divide this between us, you can kind of think of it as the plate. Everything up and to the plate is the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. When it gets to the plate at the restaurant, then it's Department of Health. And that can be somewhat confusing, and I think sometimes it can, some of the roles of our agencies can get somewhat confused, especially in the food supply arena. But remembering that the Department of Health has the restaurant and then also responsibility for investigating foodborne illness outbreaks. So they monitor counts of diseases of a foodborne illness nature. They do surveillance on that. And then if there's an indication that it's a food product, then they involve us, and then we do a trace back throughout the food supply. And then if it's a facility in Minnesota, then we do the investigation at the facility. It is important to note that we have a handful, or actually more than a handful, about nine local health agencies that do grocery store inspections. They're delegated from the Commissioner of Agriculture. So they have delegated authority. We have an agreement with them to conduct grocery store inspections within their jurisdiction. So in summary, we've got food safety regulations from all the way from animal feed to grocery stores. And it's important to realize that food, both in our statutes as well as FDA regulations, animal feed is considered food because it's a natural extension. What goes into animals, particularly livestock, ends up in humans someday. And so we've got dairy food, feed, meat, and poultry processing regulations. So our video really talked about what our inspectors do with our companies, and the majority of those companies are very compliant. But just within any population, there are going to be some of those that don't want to comply, whether they are unwilling or unable to comply with food safety regulations. And this can have public health ramifications, but it also can reflect poorly on those companies that are doing a good job. So what happens when a facility is unable or unwilling to comply with food safety regulations? What's the process in Minnesota? Well, we have an enforcement process that starts at the inspection level. If an inspector sees deficiencies, they will write up the violations and give them orders to correct the deficiencies. Some of those are corrected on site. And if there's something that's particularly egregious, like rodents running around or rodent droppings, then they can be given a sanitary notice, which is more of an order to clean things up on a more urgent note. Then reinspections take place. So the firm has an opportunity to correct those violations and then show the inspector that these things have been taken care of. If things are still not as they should be, then our supervisor gets involved and warning letters are issued. And there's a process where it's not just one warning letter, there can be a series of warning letters that go out. If things aren't progressing, then it goes into our compliance area. It moves from the inspector and the supervisor to our compliance area. And we bring the firm in to our facility and have a meeting with them. And this is their opportunity to describe their side of the story. Because in any case, there's always two sides, and we can get a biased view, and in some cases, from our inspector. So this is the place for the firm to air their views. If things look as the inspector and the supervisor have reported, then we start thinking about whether or not we want to issue a citation. For the first violation, it's a we have two ways of going about this. We can either go the administrative way, or we can go a criminal way. The first way is the administrative way. And it's $1,000 for each violation and $1,500 for subsequent violations. If the firm decides to appeal that, then an administrative hearing is held and it's presided by an administrative law judge. And the Department of Agriculture pays all the court costs with the administrative hearing. Here's a kind of a description, more of a pyramid approach, that kind of describes what I've been describing in text. First, we've got the corrective actions by the inspector, the re-inspection by the inspector. Then it moves up a level to the supervisor at the warning letter level. If things still aren't in place, then we have the administrative meeting where our compliance area, because we don't want to have a really adversarial relationship with our inspector and the firm. We want to keep that neutral, because it is a relationship where we want to keep on a good relationship as possible. Then, at that point, we decide whether or not we want to go the criminal route or the administrative route. And at that point, it's up to the commissioner which direction we want to go. We can go criminally, and then we compile the criminal actions, and then the commissioner decides, and it goes to the county or city attorney, and it's a criminal law judge. And this would be a misdemeanor for all those offenses. The other way we go is the administrative, and this is we get our citations, get the amount, and we have a matrix to do this, taking into account numbers of violations, how many times we've come back and had to revisit the same issue, and the willingness of the firm to comply. Now, if in 30 days if the firm does not appeal, then that decision's final. If they decide to appeal, then we undergo administrative hearing, and an administrative law judge presides, and then that decision by the administrative law judge is final. And so this just notes some of the examples of where we've had where there have been some issues with firms not complying or having outbreaks. So with that, we will take questions.
Representative Kachemaski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Kastenberg. You indicated that you also inspect transports, tankers, and things like that. They get the same inspection like a stationary facility. In other words, you're checking valves and cleanliness of containers and those types of things.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Representative? Yes, they do get an inspection. Our inspectors go out to the dairy tankers, and they have an actual permit that they have, and they need to comply with very similar sanitary regulations as stationary facilities.
Okay. Would that, Madam Chair, would that be just dairy or any food containers that are transporting raw commodities? Or?
Madam Chair?
Sure.
Representative, it's primarily dairy.
Okay. Right. If I may.
Representative Erdahl? Or you have one?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'll pass it to later. I'll come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Kastenberg. You answered one of the questions that I had on the amount of the citations, but do they have to pay for the inspection itself when an inspector comes in?
Madam Chair? Yes. Representative, they pay a licensing fee that's determined by their gross sales. If they have the first inspection, there's no charge for it, but if we have to go in and re-inspect, then they are charged for that activity.
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Kastenberg. I was wondering if the frequency or the level of inspections has changed over the years very much. I don't know what kind of resources you have to work with, but that's changed very much in recent years, and if that's had an impact on, again, the level or frequency of inspections.
Madam Chair? Representative? The level frequency for the facilities is based on risk, and we have three main categories: high, medium, and low. High risk is our facilities that we wind up inspecting them every year, Medium is 18 months, and low risk, like prepackaged food, you know, like your Joann's Fabrics, for instance, that's prepackaged food, those are a real big risk. So those are every 2 years. Some of the things have changed in what we focus on, particularly in light of the recent Peanut Corporation of America, the peanut butter outbreak. We have focused more, we're starting to focus, and this is a thing that's going on nationally, where we're looking at contamination of the environment, particularly in foods that are processed in a very dry environment. Salmonella has a tendency to grow or compete very well in dry environments, and so there's a potential, if it's in the environment, that it can get onto food contact surfaces or onto the product itself and contaminate that. So the frequency of inspections may not change, but how we do those inspections are going to change. They're going to be more in depth in the future. And it's going to be more of looking at the firm's laboratory records to see what kind of sampling and testing that they're doing, and really how well that they have control of their process. It's not, because when we're in there, we just look at a snapshot in time. But what we need to do is look at their records to see that they have control of the process, so that they're doing what they say they're doing when we're not there.
Representative Keith,
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, one of the slides that you showed was talking about once you do see a violation, something that is wrong within a facility, what is the timeline that they have to actually become compliant? Does it vary? How? And then how do you set up then the reinspections, or what is that process?
Kassimer.
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on the violation. How fast it needs to be rectified is... you know, if it's a light bulb that's out, well, that, you know, we get plenty of time for that. But if the employees aren't washing their hands and they're seeing them prepare food, that's got to be changed right away. Or if the food temperatures are way high on something that needs to be refrigerated, that needs to be taken care of right away. So it's dependent upon the seriousness and urgency of the violation.
Representative excuse me. Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And these might be two interrelated questions. One would be the inspection of import commodities, if there are raw materials coming into the state, are they inspected? And then also, we had a lot of problems with mold in grains this fall with the wet harvest. Is the department also inspecting grains that are going into the pet food processes, some of those things?
Madam Chair, Representative, for raw agricultural commodities coming into the United States, that is a federal responsibility. So we don't have jurisdiction over that. We do inspections of both pet food as well as other animal feed as well, and some samples are taken from there. I'm going to refer to our other area. Mr. Reed is also in charge of our feed inspection program. He's the manager of that, so he maybe can speak a little bit more to some of the toxin issues.
Madam Chair.
Can you say your name for me?
My name is David. Last name is Reed, R-E-A-D, and I manage the food and the animal feed inspection programs in the Dairy and Food Inspection Division. And to go back just briefly on imports, we do look at imports when we're doing manufacturing inspections. We do not inspect at borders. That is a federal responsibility. But once a product comes into the country, they're not inspecting 100% of those products. So when we do our normal inspections, we are looking for imported products in those firms. As far as mycotoxin, nationally, there's a coming issue right now with Don. I was just on a conference call before this committee, and there will be a number of states that are going to be asked to do inspections in states where they've been finding problems. At this point, I'm not aware that we have found significant problems with mycotoxins in Minnesota. But we may be asked to look as part of that national proposal.
Yeah. Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I brought it up is because I heard that in other states where some of the feeds have been contaminated, they've actually been losing livestock to contaminated, you know, mycotoxins or what have you in the grain supply.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that there is at least 15 states that they're having some significant problems, and they are looking pretty intensely in those states.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Rowland.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For either one of you testifiers, what happens in the extreme incident where you go through the administrative law, you go through the criminal law, and somebody still ignores you and continues to do just as they were?
Madam Chair, Representative, then we would have to go towards an injunction. We have to get an injunction against them, and we would also look at removal of their license.
Representative Shimfansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to dominate the conversation here, but one of the other things was the inspection of groceries, and sometimes these general merchandise stores or home improvement centers have a line of groceries in them. Are you getting into all those facilities as well?
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on the jurisdiction. We've got 9 delegated agencies within the metro area, and they're responsible for those. If it's a mixed type of things, like Menards sometimes has those, we get into those as well if they're within our facility.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Ruzicki.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Greg Bozicki, and I'm the Division Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. And while Heidi is assisting us, I can provide a few words of introduction. About half of the division's responsibility is involved with regulatory affairs. And the purpose of our presentation today here is to describe our regulatory process and our enforcement authorities to the committee. With me is Paul Lamont, who is the Assistant Director of the Division, overseeing our regulatory programs. And Greg Kremers is to my right. Greg is an inspector. He's been with us for about 20 years. He's based out of St. Cloud, and before that he was at the University of Minnesota doing some research over there. What we'd like to do is to show you a short video. It's about 5 minutes, and after that Paul will describe, take us through a PowerPoint which describes some of our work and some of our authority, and Greg will describe a little bit of what we do in the field, and we'll open it up for questions. Of course, if you have questions as we proceed, please ask them. The video that we're about to show you is something that I've reported to the committees in the past. It's a program that we developed. It's actually a computer application that we began developing a number of years ago, and we do have it operational in the field. It's called a compliance information system. And the purpose of it, very simply, I think that it will explain itself, but the purpose of it is to make sure that we do an organized inspection. We do about 14 different inspection types, I believe the number is. And this also, then once the data is entered, it's a one-time entry, it's paperless, so these are become our official documents as well. And we put this into this video system so that we could explain this, because frankly it's kind of hard to explain unless you have somebody actually take you through it. So, Madam Chair, without further ado.
Thank you.
It's a computer system like no other. CIS, or Compliance Information System, has been designed by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division to revolutionize the way the agency does its job, enforcing the laws that apply to its regulated clientele, protecting the safety of all Minnesotans, and ensuring a healthy environment. What makes this system unique? It's completely paperless. No more file cabinets upon file cabinets filled with forms. It's portable, whether an MDA employee is in Roseau conducting a routine inspection or in Red Wing looking into a misuse complaint. They can all be logged into CIS. It's also an all-in-one tool. Inspectors have direct access to individual and company licensing information, aerial maps, previous inspection reports, and more.
Perhaps the most powerful thing about CIS is that it provides to our field inspectors all the information that we have about our regulatory programs to them in the field while they're on site. At the same time, what they're able to do is to provide all the information that they have back to St. Paul.
After 4 years of development and testing, the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division has transferred all of its work to CIS. It now carries out its regulatory function in Minnesota using this high-tech tool. CIS delivers several important benefits to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and its stakeholders. First, Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division employees benefit from greater real-time access to important regulatory information. With CIS installed on laptop computers, the system can be transported and accessed by inspectors anywhere in the state. After these workers simply connect to the internet, office staff can then see the progress of inspections and any completed paperwork within hours.
I've got a question about something. I mean, I can go to my docking station in my office and send the inspection to St. Paul, and we can talk about if I had some questions, certain questions about different things. They can look at photos that I send or look at the inspection and make, you know, we can make a decision right then and there. Is this right? Is this wrong? Or do we need to change something? Or
CIS also provides uniformity, whether it's a routine inspection, an investigation into a misuse complaint, or response to an ag chemical emergency. CIS provides employees with uniform guidelines and standards when doing their job. Inspectors simply call up one of 14 different scenarios and answer a series of questions tailored to the type of facility or situation. CIS also provides flexibility to MDA staff. Inspectors can add comments to reports, and staff has the ability to update and add information without the need of a computer programmer. Another group benefiting from the compliance information system is MDA's regulated clientele. CIS has standardized the way inspections are conducted across the state. This means all laws are carried out the same way by each inspector. And after an inspection is finished, CIS can determine the action item or order that needs to be followed to bring a facility into compliance with the law. These are typed, legible, and consistent from case to case.
I think it's a very big step in the right direction for consistency in the field. Having been in the agriculture business for 29 years, I think I can see the real need for consistency and fairness from one dealer to the next, from one inspector to the next.
Finally, each Minnesotan may see a benefit from CIS. Before the computer system, inspectors would fill out forms in the field, mail or deliver them to MDA's headquarters in St. Paul, where they would be copied, distributed, and filed. But now with CIS, that cumbersome process is gone. CIS acts as an online filing system and database, accessible by all authorized MDA employees. This technology has streamlined regulatory oversight, creating a more effective government.
When we get complaints, we don't really know if it's just an isolated situation or not. Now we have the ability to go in the system, be able to search by lots of different parameters, and be able to tell what it is that we're dealing with. And that's very different than before, because we'd have to, in the past, do hard copy tallies on things like that.
The tools MDA staff now have at their fingertips can also serve as a life-saving resource in an emergency situation. Consider a scenario of a chemical spill with human exposure. An MDA employee on scene at the emergency can use their laptop containing CIS to quickly access pesticide labeling information for medical personnel, ensuring victims receive proper treatment. As shown, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has a powerful tool to carry out its pesticide and fertilizer inspections and regulatory duties in the state. However, this is just a small fraction of what the compliance information system can do. Soon other regulatory divisions within MDA will be using this system, such as dairy inspectors on the farm. It will guarantee accuracy and fairness while improving efficiency, important goals for Minnesota agriculture and Minnesota taxpayers.
Madam Chair, the use of CIS is going to be very helpful for us. A lot of the benefits we're going to see down the road are going to be because it's a paperless system now. We'll be able to keep our files on the system, so we'll be able to we won't have to deal with all the paper that we used to have, all the files and, of course, data practices and all. That's a very important step for us. But it's just a tool. We still are dependent upon the people who are located in Greater Minnesota to do our inspections and the people in St. Paul. And we have processes that we'd like to explain to you. So Paul will take us through that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Paul Lemont, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I was asked to just give you an overview of our regulatory activities, and I put a PowerPoint together. I'll try to maybe add information as I go. At one point, I'm going to ask our Inspector Greg Kramers to explain in further detail the field work that we do. And then in conclusion, as Greg said, we'll have questions if you have those. The Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division is part of the Department of Agriculture. Under Minnesota statutes, we are authorized to administer and enforce the Minnesota Pesticide Law and Minnesota Fertilizer Laws, and the chapters are indicated. MDA is also delegated through a cooperative agreement with US EPA authority to enforce the US federal pesticide law, which is called FIFRA. If in instances where some compliance issues cross state lines, oftentimes we will be asked to perform an inspection or an investigation and then simply send our findings to the EPA, and they would have other states do likewise if it's an interstate problem. Our approach is one that we've used for many years. I think it was developed Commissioner Nichols and then Commissioner Rudolin, and now with Commissioner Hugesson. And I think it crosses all of our divisions, but certainly in our division, our objective is to provide accurate, timely, best information possible, to provide training opportunities, to educate people that we regulate with that information, to utilize our professional inspectors and staff to do outreach in the field and through meetings to provide the compliance assistance. And then we get down to the more traditional regulatory activities where we do check for compliance, the compliance monitoring, and in certain occasions we need to take an enforcement response. So that's our strategy to move through that, and particularly it's worth mentioning that with new regulations, whether they be federal regulations that EPA is asking us to enforce or state regulations, we always try to adopt this approach and give our agricultural chemical clientele an opportunity to learn what needs to be complied with and then to check on that compliance. I should be careful here to let you know that in Minnesota we have a definition of agricultural chemicals in the statutes, and that means pesticides, fertilizers, soil and plant amendments. Excuse me. And the MDA, essentially, our work in the division under these laws, we inspect sites and facilities, and we inspect persons, and we license persons or permit persons to manufacture, formulate, distribute, use, dispose of, store, or transport agricultural chemicals. That essentially is what the regulatory part of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division does. Now, you wonder, who are the people and the products I'm talking about? This is sort of a collection of data that we pulled together for this hearing, but I think it offers to you, and many of you in the on the committee may indeed be licensed or certified under one or more of these categories. I know in the past I've found that to be true. But we have almost 6,000 commercial applicators in Minnesota. We have over 3,000 non-commercial, and those are the people that do the work as part of their employment. The structural pest control applicators are the traditional exterminators that you know about, that go into homes and businesses to take care of rodents, and actually a lot of the pests that you just heard spoken to by our food and dairy division inspections. We have pesticide dealers in Minnesota. We have private pesticide applicators, and those, I should put in parentheses, those are oftentimes farmers. And farmers need to be certified to use what are called restricted use pesticides. To buy them and to use them, they must be certified. We have commercial animal waste technicians. We register in Minnesota, and this is a number that's increasing because we're in a registration period, over 11,000 and sometimes as much as 12,000 different pesticide products. We issue over 1,700 fertilizer licenses. We register over almost 3,500 fertilizer products, and soil and plant amendments, small category, but significantly that we do that work. Every year, and on an annual basis, we have recertification workshops throughout Minnesota, so people can get relicensed or recertified. We have here, I've indicated 152, but that number varies per year. And either at our St. Paul office over at the Freeman Building or out in the field, we administer over 2,500 examinations for these licenses. So I think this gives you a feeling of the large number of clients that we have and that essentially we regulate. Our work is, if I can say how we plan to do our work, and sometimes we can't always work according to plan, but we have two sorts of activities. We perform routine compliance assistance and compliance monitoring inspections at our ag chem facilities, at the small town co-ops, at the Home Depots where they sell pesticides, at farm and garden stores, and that sort of at sites that are chemigating in the field, at sites where they are storing or using anhydrous ammonia. That is one component of our work, and that is scheduled work. It's certainly seasonal, but we try to vary our work tasks over the whole year, and Greg Kramers will speak to that a bit more in just a second. The second half of what we do is we respond to complaints about these products, whether it's a fertilizer or a pesticide, whether it's a misuse, whether it's a fire or a spill, whether it's a transport accident, whether it's a bogus product being marketed in Minnesota, we respond to those reports and complaints. So our work is twofold. This is a map of Minnesota that I think you would probably benefit from knowing that we have right now 11 positions that serve as inspector investigators. One of them is vacant right now. But these are the districts that we have assigned in Minnesota. And our inspectors live and work in the field, And through the CIS system, are in instant contact with our St. Paul office. I think I'm going to pause right now, and I'll move on to this, but I'll introduce Greg Kramers, because I know the questions that came to us prior to this hearing were exactly what do we do, how do we do it, where do we do it. I hope I've given you a feel for that. But Greg and I thought that it was worthwhile having one of our seasoned inspectors speak to you briefly about his work.
Greg. Thanks, Paul. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Greg Kramers, and I am what we call an Ag Chemical Investigator, ACI. It's kind of the acronym we use. And I'm based in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I currently cover five counties, Benton, Stearns, Morrison, Crowing, and Todd. That's kind of my region, as you've seen from the map. But what I'm going to do today is kind of walk you through one of the 14 inspection processes, and that's the complaint inspection process of what us inspectors do. Basically, we end up getting many times a phone call or maybe even an email in regard to from homeowners or farmers, pesticide applicators, businesses, or local and state government agencies in regard to violations or what they think are violations of the pesticide or fertilizer law. And we get them in and we kind of prioritize which ones need to be responded to immediately, and that's in the case of a human exposure or animal death or a fish kill, something like that, that ranks up and we're going to respond immediately. Also, second priority would be like a pesticide drift or something to like a crop. And then also like drift to lawns or gardens or something like that, ornamental trees, personal property that the complainants are concerned about. And then kind of a low priority is we get a lot of complaints from in regard to unlicensed applicators. So that's kind of how we stack our priorities in regard to the complaints, because we receive like right around probably 200 complaints a year. But we triage these complaint information and determine if the information is credible. We can look up to see who is licensed on our website. But the state law requires that these complainants must file a written complaint, fill out a form to make an official complaint. And basically, if it's an application issue, that application has to be completed within 45 days from the complaint. So if it gets too much longer than that, we can't pull samples and that kind of thing, and it doesn't help to prove our case. But basically, we set up an inspection in that CIS program that you've seen in the video, get the reporting information in there, and try and get that as soon as we can, depending on the busyness of the season. And then we'll visit with the complainant, and we'll view their property, and take information from them, look at patterns of damage if it's a drift complaint, injury symptoms on the vegetation, and basically from there, we'll take samples. If we feel there's definite violation here, we'll pull samples. And it can be vegetation, soil, sometimes water, or in case of a human exposure, it's clothing from the affected individual. And we'll submit that to our MDA laboratory, and they'll analyze for the pesticides that we're looking for. And from there, we'll go to the responsible party that conducted the application. And ask them questions, get application records, product labels, verify the weather information that they have on their application records, and offer them a statement in regard to the complaint. Did they feel something went wrong during their application, that kind of thing, so they have a chance to tell their side of the story. Some investigations require what we call a food crop commodity advisory issuance, and that's when we'll work with Heidi and Dave Reed. Basically, because sometimes it warrants the case where the crop needs to be destroyed or plowed down if there's no food tolerances in regard to the pesticide. So, then the final step is kind of write up a narrative summary, a factual summary with the chronological events of what happened during the investigation. And we like to get that pretty much wrapped up within 1 to 2 weeks after getting the call. If it works out, again, it depends on how many complaint calls we get. But my goal, I guess, as an inspector, is always to educate the clientele in regard to the violations and the fertilizer and pesticide laws. So, thank you.
I can continue, and then we all three will be here for questions, if you wish. Greg mentioned in his comments about sampling. We have a laboratory that I know many of you, if you haven't visited, you should, because it's a state-of-the-art laboratory that we share with the Department of Health on Robert Street right next to our building. We believe this is one of the most best-equipped and a highly resourced, capable laboratories in the United States for pesticide analysis. So we have that tool available to us. And oftentimes when our field inspectors will need to verify what people are saying, a sample can be a very, very strong piece of evidence. Also, aside from the regulatory side, we do take a substantial amount of samples and make sure the product is what it claims to be. And this is what many times a person in the industry will want us to do to keep the playing field level and to make sure there's a fair marketplace. So I didn't want to go beyond that in telling you that. And finally, I guess, when we do have a fire, when we do have an accident, when we are trying to determine the extent of an incident, we can do sampling, soil sampling and so forth, to determine the scope of the cleanup. There were questions to us about what our remedies do we use, what are in our laws when we do have non-compliance. We have a number of administrative sorts of remedies. We call them notices of violation. They're written warnings. We can issue what are called cease and desist orders. An inspector like Mr. Kramer's might be out at an anhydrous ammonia facility and see something that needs to be fixed or stopped immediately. He can issue a cease and desist order. That's usually done if it's a high-risk non-compliance issue. If there is something that can be corrected, we can issue a corrective action order and give a certain time limit for the corrections to occur. And finally, if some violations are documented, the commissioner has, under the Minnesota Pesticide Law and Fertilizer Law, the three authorities, the administrative, the civil, and the criminal enforcement opportunity. Excuse the overlay there a little bit, but I thought it would be useful, and it sort of ties the comments that Greg made to you. Once our field work is completed and the CIS system electronically instantly produces that information in St. Paul, what do we do with it? Particularly the instances where there's a regulatory compliance issue. All of those inspections, all of the investigations of complaints are reviewed and evaluated by the program supervisors and then moved up to division management level if there's an issue. If there's an enforcement response that is proposed or appropriate, those responses are approved, are reviewed and approved by the supervisors and the division management. And I put here that in certain instances where there's been egregious noncompliance, repeated violations, a person has a history of violations, or if the violations are such that the penalty being proposed is substantial, those types of actions are moved up through division management to the commissioner's office for their review and approval. There were questions to our division about, well, exactly how many of these things do you work with? Our CIS system is going to be capable of producing very good reports, sophisticated reports, but we're learning how to use it. But for the sake of this hearing, we put together at least this information for you because I think it gives you a feel for what we've just been describing. Over the last couple of years, we have performed well over 1,000 inspections slash investigations. Those would be the routine inspections of facilities and so forth, and the complaints that have come in. Of those inspections, we have found it necessary to issue warning letters, or as I gave you an example before, a cease and desist order to a person or facility a little over 400 times. I guess that's about 40% or so of occasions. But this is just telling somebody, we have regulations, you are out of compliance, come into compliance in the following method, according to the following schedule, and we go on about our business. In certain instances, there are violations documented where we issue penalty enforcement actions, but as you see in this instance, or in this slide, those are a small percentage of our total activity. And I do have some data on the types of penalties we issue, the different areas that we issue them in, but some of the topic areas that I mentioned, storage, handling, transport, use, those are the areas where we do find some noncompliance. That concludes my overview for you. I would be happy to answer any questions you have, and I know Greg and Greg Gazicki and Greg Kramers would also.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of related questions about the CIS system. Does information that is in that system get shared by other departments? For example, would PCA learn about a spill, or does USDA get the information so we can compare with national incident rates and things like that? That first part.
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, the information in CIS is public information with the exception of that which is not public. In other words, it's just like our files, but there's some information like complainant information that under our statute is kept private. Certain things like telephone numbers and so forth under data practices. But the information is public, so if anybody wanted to request information or file, we would be under the Data Practices Act obliged to share that. But we do not share this information. We're not linked up. No one else is accessing this. This is a basically a standalone application that is housed in the division, managed by the department, and you have to have access rights to it.
Madam Chair,
Representative Doty,
follow up on that is a little more technical question. Is it possible to save your data in a universal format or anything like that, or is this a completely closed system so that you can't share data other than someone going to your website reading what is public information? I'm talking about the computer-to-computer exchange of information here. Is that physically possible with your system, or are you completely in a silo that this is only MDA that's going to be able to use the information internally?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, at this time it's ours, and we protect this because of some of the issues that I just mentioned. I believe that would be possible to do such a thing. It would take programming, it would take funding, it would take a good reason why we would want to do that. At this time, for example, we do interconnect with, we are working, the development of the program is working to interconnect with the another computer application system called the department's licensing information system. So I do know we can make connections like that, but at this point, we were happy to get this thing operational, and it was, and right now, actually, the Dairy and Food Division is going through the process so that they can become operational as well. So we've got our hands full with programming, I guess.
And one final question, Madam Chair. Is it easily possible by the user in the field, for example, to keep track of something that's not built into the software? If we all of a sudden decide that
I don't know what we want. If, you know, heaven forbid we give you guys more requirements to go check on or something like that, is it possible to, for the, when he's in my district out there, is it possible for him to add a new category and put that in there, or is it built into the software so that we have to pay professionals a gazillion dollars and take a gazillion weeks to get it to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative, that, great question. We designed this in anticipation. The wonderful thing about this is the people like Greg and some of other staff, we designed it from the grassroots up, and we know those kinds of things happen. So we designed it so, and it was actually in the video, just a sentence in the video, but it's actually designed so that our administrator, the supervisor of a program, not an IT professional, can actually go in and change a question, make some modifications without doing something like that. What we've found is there's always improvements that we can make. The programmers can always make improvements, and we find things, but we designed it so we can make what I would call minor adjustments very easily without any cost.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Buzicki and Mr. Lamont and Mr. Kramers. And I think I've talked to Mr. Buzicki and Mr. Lamont about a particular situation in my district. I wonder about the authority of the agency and the history of the discussion about Mr. Lamont invoked the term fair marketplace and where that fits in. And as I look at your goals, are to protect human and animal health, ensure the safety of food, feed, and minimize effects on the environment. I don't see anything in there talking about a fair marketplace. And Mr. Lamont, I did challenge you on some of the approaches to some of the sanctions and how they are arrived at. So I'd be interested in your response.
Well, Madam Chair, I of course cannot talk about an open enforcement action, but in general, I guess I can make a few comments. First off, it's probably good for you to know the history of our authority. I've been working with the department since 1985, and during 1985 and 1986, I had occasion to bring some enforcement matters in district court in both Morrison County and I think Stearns County. And in both instances, we only had criminal authority at that time. And from the bench, the judges said, why are you bringing criminal charges against someone for improper storage or pesticide grift? And I said, well, that's all we have. And he said, well, I think you should talk to the legislature. Fortunately, in 1987 and 1989, the legislature did authorize the commissioner to do administrative, civil, and criminal enforcement. So it's a more appropriate tool for noncompliance. In regard to the fair marketplace, and I can't go back to the slide, but the slide I showed you that we had persons licensed, that's their livelihood. They are in the business of applying pesticides and fertilizers. I showed you a line item that showed you the number of products registered. Those are companies that are in the marketplace producing products, labeling properly according to regulations, and they want a fair marketplace. And so if we find that somebody is distributing a product or storing a product that in a way that is out of compliance with our basic regulations, the ag chemical industry in Minnesota looks to us to bring those things into a level playing field. That if a facility in Haynesville, Minnesota has spent $20,000 to construct proper containment so that if a pesticide container leaks, it is contained in a secondary containment, that a facility or a person in Rochester, Minnesota that is storing the same or similar type products is expected to do the same. That the equal protection goes across Minnesota. And so our job is to try to bring a consistent and uniform regulatory structure to the people that are in this business. And the ag chemical business in Minnesota is a very, very high volume, prosperous business. There are a lot of products used, and there's a lot of risk involved. And so we try to protect the environment. We try to make people aware of their compliance, our expectations of compliance, and for those that vary, we go into the enforcement mode. I hope I've answered your question.
And Madam Chair, Representative Sikowski, I just echo Paul's comment. We do hear a lot from industry about having a level playing field. And I think in the video, who is in the agricultural chemical business, he actually served on the ACRA board, which is our reimbursement program. I think you heard him say he sees a need in his 29 years of experience to have some firm and consistent regulations across the field. So while perhaps we didn't highlight it, that is one of the purposes that we strive for, is making sure that people are handling these products in a way that's the proper way and it's uniformly enforced. And that, frankly, that is one of the reasons that we developed the compliance inspection systems, so that we could actually have that database and so we could do a better job of reviewing and making sure that we're doing things uniformly. So that is one of our goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both. I appreciate the notion that the outcome provides for those items that you mentioned, but I wonder about, is it in your mission, and is it statutorily, or is it in rule anywhere that you are to consider the marketplace in the decision making around sanctions and other types of activities that you engage in? It seems to me that the legislature authorizes you to do certain things and expects you to do certain things and to make your decisions and follow through on those. And if the effect of those activities contributes collectively to a fair marketplace, then that is good that happens. But where in statute or rule are you authorized to use your judgment on a case-by-case basis upon what effect that may have, what effect the circumstances may have on the marketplace? And anyway, that's my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Sikowski, I'd have to go back and review the statute, and I'd like the opportunity to do that and cite some language. I know there is some particular language in us when we consider our penalties, what we can take into account. But I'd have to go back and actually look at that. I believe there is language that addresses those issues, but I'd have to review it. I can get back to you.
Thank you.
Representative Skinansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and first of all, Mr. Bozicki, thank you for the pesticide and fertilizer newsletters that come out. They're very helpful, and I appreciate those. And I appreciate receiving them by mail, because they come by email, they just get overlooked with a lot of other things, so with the information flow that we have around here. But the other thing I noticed in your presentation was that, you had 2008 and 2009 statistics, and I want to congratulate you for that. That, if your system is that well automated that you're getting statistics, shortly after year end, I think that's very important in the fast-moving, environment that we're in. But the question I have deals with on-farm fertilizer storage, and is a farmer and expected or anticipated to be aware of what the regulations are if he buys several tons of fertilizer and has it dropped in a storage facility on his farm? is he required to know what the regs are, and if not, what's his circumstance?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, thank you for your comment about our newsletter. We actually have discussions about that, and it's our belief that some of the paper newsletters that we send around to send to a facility actually gets in their coffee room and gets routed in inner office, and oddly enough, we hear that paper is a good thing sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all on our website, so if anybody ever wants to go back and review them, I shouldn't say all, but we do have back issues. And to be fair, the numbers that we showed you, 2008, 2009, we asked staff to assemble those. We still are working to learn the system, but we actually asked staff to assemble the federal fiscal year numbers, which closed, so we had a little bit more time, but we thought it would be representative. The system's actually been up and operating since January 1st, 2008, so that's why we have 2 years of numbers that we can use. To your question on-farm storage, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but we have seen an increase in, especially in recent years, in liquid fertilizer on-farm storage, and more recently, especially because of the price changes, the radical price changes, we were getting an increase request for on-farm storage of dry. And so the expectation, well, we look at the information that comes in on a site-specific basis, situation-specific, so we will look to see if the grower is, for example, a certified applicator. If it's a certified applicator, the grower is getting newsletters, and we have cited that before. There is an expectation that they've gone through workshops or testing so that they do have some feel for it. At the very least, they have a phone number to call if there is a question. So the answer is it's site-specific, but if it's dealing with a large amount for a large period of time, most farmers are familiar with purchasing fertilizer from their facilities. And when you go to a facility and you see the containment and you see the modern facilities that have that those companies or co-ops have invested in, we believe there's a certain amount of common sense or realization that those that fertilizer is stored in that way for a while for a reason, and they're inspected. So there is an expectation, but we do try to take all the circumstances into account, and we will ask a grower that's in the situation to present their side of the story as well.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more quick question about the capabilities of the CIS, this time about its potential as a rapid response tool. I'm just going to make some wild story up here and see if how this would let's say somebody spills something onto something else, and nobody's ever spilled those two things together before, and something really bad happened. Can you go in to this and find out who in the state has those chemicals so that they can be contacted really quickly and say, hey, don't do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, at this time, no. We don't have that capability. It is pretty much limited to what we either enter on an inspection basis or what kind of information we can access that is essentially a filing cabinet that we attach to it. So it would have, along with your example, let's say, first of all, when there is an incident, the emergency responder is the incident commander. So it's normally a fire chief is normally in charge. And we respond 24/7, but we will respond in support role. So we will be viewed as an information source, basically in the shadows, but being able to provide information. If the incident commander, the fire chief, is looking for information, they have access to their MSDS sheets or other information sources. If there's something in particular that we can get, like pesticide labels or MSDS sheets, we would be able to do that. But but not in terms of like you're talking about two chemicals mixed together. Unless it was on an MSDS sheet, we wouldn't have that.
Thank you.
Representative Doty. Any other questions? Adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.